I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, encounters that move us beyond words. Your host for this episode is Eric Schultzke.
On a spring day in a southern city, a 12-year-old boy walked with a group of kids from the local church to the city hall. And as they walked, they sang,
I ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me round. Keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching onto freedom land.
They sang for themselves, they sang for each other, and they sang for everyone else who was listening. And there were a lot of people listening. In fact, the whole world was tuned in. The date was May 4th, 1963, and the place was Birmingham, Alabama. 1963 was a key inflection point in American history, and this was especially true in Birmingham. To have been smack dab in the middle of that, as a participant, not just as an observer, would have been like carrying a weapon at Gettysburg or Bunker Hill. And these were just kids.
My first name, Freeman, I'm Freeman Hrabowski III. My grandfather, born in about 1870, was in the first generation of those born free among his sisters and brothers, and they named him Freeman rather than Freedman. My father was born in 1910, and I was born in 1950, and so you're back to the son of a slave in a matter of a few years and three generations.
As a boy, Freeman Hrabowski III was very conscious of the legacy of his name. It was one thing to have been freed. It was another to have been born free. Three generations later, his name still proclaimed his birthright. And yet, this was Birmingham, Alabama in the 50s. And the promises of the Civil War and the 13th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution were still unrealized dreams.
There were times when I would say as a kid, why can't we go in there and just sit down? And they would say, well, blacks are not allowed to do that. And that was when I was very young. You accepted what you saw on TV. You accepted the fact that we couldn't go in front doors or that we couldn't drink out of the water fountain, all those things. Black children learned that the world was not fair and that we were not treated as equals. What our parents said was, but we are all children of God and we are equal. And this is something that has to change. The question that children would often ask is, well, how long is it going to take for it to change? I'm not going to be a child for so long.
Life does indeed come at you fast. 60 years later, Freeman Hrabowski III is now President Emeritus of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He retired last year after 30 years of distinguished service at the helm. It's a rare opportunity to sit down with someone who was not only present at a key moment in history, but who actually helped change history for the better. But I found myself equally fascinated as I spoke with Freeman Hrabowski about who he is and where he came from. I got to better know an unusual place and time and a people who had carried themselves with an unyielding passion for fairness and with a calm confidence and grace in pursuing it.
I quote Browning in his statement, all that a man's reach should exceed his grasp or what's a heaven for. That we either continue to stretch to be better or we become complacent. And when you're complacent, you don't remain the same. You move backwards, you regress. There's no doubt about that. Living things, we don't remain the same. Either we are improving in whatever the area or we are losing it.
You hear this combination of uncompromising passion and calm confidence in Martin Luther King's voice. You recognize it in the voices of others who worked with him, and you certainly hear it in Freeman Hrabowski III, and you will see it in his parents. To stake a firm claim on justice, to be unsatisfied with the imperfect present, but somehow still live with serenity and composure, even in the face of extreme persecution, Maybe the best phrase for all of this is divine discontent. The earliest instance of that phrase that I could find is in 1793, but its most famous use may be from W.E.B. Du Bois, the indefatigable civil rights activist. In a 1940 speech, Du Bois said, "I cannot promise you happiness always, but I can promise you divine discontent with the imperfect."
I tell the story in maybe the second grade. I was very young, and we had these books with the brown paper around them, and we were told not to tear the paper off. Well, I was always the rebel, and I'd finished my math work and bored, so I started peeling back. And all of a sudden, I realized it's got the name of another school on it. And I realized it's the white school. And then I just tear the paper off, and the book is raggedy. And I go up to the teacher, and I say, "Why did they give us their hand-me-down books?" And she was shocked, first of all, that I picked up on it. She wasn't sure what to say, and she finally said, "I thought I told you not to tear that paper off those books, right?" I kept looking at her. I was so angry. And she said, "You just remember that you are not second class. You are not something involving hand-me-down anything, that you are a child of God, and you are as good as anybody else, number one." Then she said, "And the book on the outside may be second rate, but the knowledge is still first rate. Get the knowledge, because you don't have time to be a victim." Something that my parents had told me before: you don't have time to be a victim. Just get the knowledge. The world is not fair, but get the knowledge.
Freeman's teacher here was preaching to the choir. There was no way this kid wasn't going to get the knowledge. Getting an education for him was a given, just as getting teased was a way of life.
They would say, "There you are with that math again. Wait a minute." But a great story. My principal would come in, and he was a mathematician, and he would put a problem on the board, and he says, "When somebody can solve it, just see me in the hallway." And so everybody knew I was a little nerdy, and I was younger than my classmates, but I was working on that problem. We could get a dime. And with a dime, I could buy 10 Tootsie Rolls. I would use those Tootsie Rolls to get people to feel better about me.
When 1963 rolled around, this nerdy kid, this ninth grader, was doing nerdy ninth grader stuff. In April, anti-segregation protests heated up in Birmingham. Martin Luther King was arrested, and he wrote his famous letter from Birmingham jail. As the month wore on, the Birmingham civil rights protest campaign faltered, though. Adults balked at protesting and joining MLK in jail. They couldn't feed their families or pay the rent from jail. But at this point, to Freeman Hrabowski, Martin Luther King was mostly still just a name. Then a civil rights leader named James Bevel suggested that the children should step up to the plate and march and get arrested. Dr. King was at first opposed, as were many others. It was kind of a nutty idea, but the idea took on momentum. Some of Freeman's friends were set to march. May 2nd was D-Day, the first day of the children's march.
Time Magazine, May 10th, 1963. Birmingham saw a small civil war last week. Whites against Negroes, cops against children, dogs against humans. It began when the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. decided to throw school children into the Negro battle line. Police Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor, arch-segregationist, viciously retaliated with club-swinging cops, police dogs, and blasts of water from fire hoses. There were no winners in Birmingham last week. On the first day, the demonstrations were a bit like a picnic. The youngsters clapped and sang excitedly, and when Connor's men arrested them, they scampered almost merrily into patrol wagons. About 800 youthful Negroes wound up in Birmingham jails that day. A troop of new marchers left King's Church command post next day intoning, "We want freedom." They passed several hundred Negro adults in a park near the church and marched towards a mass line of lawmen, ignoring a police captain who warned them to stop. Black-booted firemen turned on their hoses. The kids fell back from the crushing streams. The water pressure increased. Children fell and lay there bleeding. The march stopped. But Negro adults from the park began muttering, then shouting threats at Connor's cops. Furious, the commissioner roared for his police dogs. The crowd in the park edged back. Some hurried away. "Look at 'em run," yelled Bull. Some Negroes stood their ground, flinging stones and bottles at the police. One waved a knife at an officer, but but the dogs, held on long leashes, lunged at those who retreated slowly. There was some scuffling, then the crowd broke for the church, chased by snarling dogs and club-waving cops. Five Negroes were hurt, either by dog bites or the water streams. Two policemen were bruised by stones. Another 250 Negroes, mostly youngsters, were jailed.
Peaceful protest had been met with violence, and it threatened to get worse. Robert F. Kennedy, the U.S. Attorney General and an ally of the marchers, issued a statement calling for calm. School children participating in street demonstrations is a dangerous business, Kennedy said. An injured, maimed, or dead child is a price that none of us can afford to pay. And yet, Dr. King, who had at first been a skeptic, was now all in.
That night, King held a church meeting and called for even more. "Don't worry about your children who are in jail," he cried to 1,000 of his followers. "The eyes of the world are on Birmingham. We're going on, in spite of dogs and fire hoses. We've gone too far to turn back."
On a back pew in the church, there sat a reluctant ninth grader who had been dragged along by his parents.
I was sitting in the back of church, not wanting to be there. I was 12. My parents were keeping me happy by allowing me to do the two things I loved most, eating. So I was eating M&Ms, the good kind with the peanuts. And I was doing my algebra. This was in May, and we were doing word problems. And so I was sitting in the back doing my math, eating the M&Ms, and trying to listen. And the man was captivating. He certainly was. And he said, if the children participate in this peaceful protest, all of America will understand that even our young people know the difference between right and wrong, and they want the best education possible. And as a result of this protest, our children will be able to go to better schools. Now, by better schools, of course, he meant the schools where the white kids went. We had some great black teachers. We didn't have the resources. And I was tired of those hand-me-down books from white schools. And the most important point, though, is that he inspired us to think about how the world might be. Tomorrow can be better than the world today if we make it so. And of course, by this time, I'm saying, what's his name? Who is this again? And this is when they said again, the name I'd heard, I just hadn't thought about it as a kid, Dr. Martin Luther King. I went home and just with great excitement said, I want to go. I want to go. And of course, they said, no, you can't go. And I said, you made me go and listen. And I did some of that. And now you won't let me go. You guys are hypocrites. At that time, you did not tell your parents they were hypocrites. My dad immediately said, go to your room, son. And my mother was shaking her head. And I knew I was in trouble. And it was a tough night.
Freeman's parents woke him up early the next morning.
When they came into the room, I could tell, both looked like they'd been crying. I got really scared. I was really worried. And I said, what's wrong? And they said, we couldn't sleep. We talked and prayed all night because we wanted to do the right thing. And we wanted to protect our child. It wasn't that we didn't trust you when we said you couldn't go. It was that we don't trust the people who will be over you, because if you march, you're going to jail. We are concerned about that. As I recall, they even asked me, tell us why you want to do this. And we had one more conversation, and that's when my parents said, we're going to let you go, but we're going to put you in God's hands, and we want you to be careful and to continue to pray the whole time.
That morning, Freeman went to a training session back at the same church where he had just listened to MLK the night before.
Most important, it was talking about self-discipline, that we could not become violent, that the police might say all kinds of things to us, but we were not to become angry. The worst thing you could say to a little black kid was to talk disparagingly about his mother, and they were saying they're going to say things that are going to really upset you on purpose. But you cannot become upset. You have to keep singing and looking straight ahead. And depending on where it stops, you'll be the one to pray, to kneel and pray. You will all kneel and pray at the steps of City Hall. And we were to pray for our freedom to go to better schools and our freedom to be treated as first-class citizens.
Carpools drove the children over to the 16th Street Baptist Church, their sister congregation. Hrabowski told me that he looked it up the other day and was shocked to realize that from the church to City Hall is a mere half mile and just a 10-minute walk. It seemed like forever, he told me. Four blocks up 6th Avenue, turn left, one block up 20th. And they sang, and they kept their eyes focused straight ahead.
I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching onto freedom land. And I was literally singing that and pushing others to sing it so we could be determined to keep marching and not be dissuaded by the dogs and the fire hoses and not allow ourselves to become upset by the police talking about our mothers. Just one more. I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. You know, the other side of that, woke up this morning with my mind set on Jesus. Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. And so you didn't have to have a voice, a singing voice, if you could halfway carry a tune. It was the enthusiasm rather than the beauty of the voices that gave us this strength to keep marching. I made it to City Hall and was just to kneel and pray. And just as I was getting ready to do that, the famous Bull Connor asked me, "What do you want, little Nigra?" N-I-G-G-R-A is a word that you hear when they were not saying Negro. And I explained that we wanted to, sir. And, you know, in the South, little kids said, sir, not sir. So I want to kneel and pray for our freedom. And he spat in my face, and he was looking right at me when he did it, picked me up, and threw me into the police wagon. It was very sad, very, very frightening, very frightening. It was like a nightmare to be picked up. And we were all just being pushed in there.
Hrabowski has never been comfortable talking about these 5 nights he spent in jail.
No, they were not pleasant, and I wouldn't even talk about it for a year. Well, I would say some things because I served as a child speaker for Dr. King's people when talking about the experience. But the fact is that it was horrific. We were treated like animals or slaves with too many people in the little spaces and not enough restrooms and children who were younger than I was and children crying and they would put us in with the quote-unquote bad boys, you know, the kids who were there not because of the marching. Some of those children who marched with me were beaten. I had my little group that I was responsible for, and they would stay with me. As I was 12, but I was about to go to the 10th grade, so I had skipped some grades. And so I was more mature. But the point is that at night, when the bad boys were going to come across to intimidate or beat up somebody, you should know that I was not a courageous kid. My students always told, "You must have a lot of courage." Not at all. The only thing I ever attacked in my life was a math problem. Whenever fights would come out, Freeman would run the other way. I did not want to be in a fight, all right? So get that picture. So I had to do something to protect these kids. And with all of what I've said about children being in jails and all of that, the one book that was around, all the Bibles, they did have Bibles. And so I used the Bible with the children to read. So at night when somebody would come over trying to bother some of my kids, I'd start reciting, "The Lord is my shepherd." And the kids would say, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. I shall not want." And the nice thing was I learned that the bad boys were scared of God too. So they would leave my kids alone.
After the kids had spent 5 nights in jail, Birmingham did finally let them go. But the state was not quite done tormenting them. A decree came down from the State Board of Education that the children who marched and were sent to jail were to be expelled or suspended from school, depending on their age. But Freeman's principal would beat the Board of Education at their own game.
when he got the message from the Board of Education that every principal was to suspend the students whose names were on the list of those who had gone to jail. We were called to the auditorium, but he did something very special. Rather than putting us out in a way that was disgraceful and embarrassing to us, he called each name who had gone to jail to come to the stage. He was giving us respect. He brought us to the stage and made comments that suggested we were young heroes, which I'm sure was not what the white board wanted. And he did it with dignity, and it was almost as if we were to get a badge of honor. And the teachers began, and the students gave us a standing ovation.
Atlanta, May 22nd, Associated Press. A federal appeals judge tonight overruled a lower court and ordered Birmingham, Alabama school officials to reinstate immediately hundreds of Negro children who were suspended or expelled for taking part in racial demonstrations.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. Our guest is Freeman Hrabowski III, the recently retired president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the author of The Resilient University, How Purpose and Inclusion Drive Student Success. Up next, in church, listening to MLK again, this time a tragic postscript to the Children's March.
I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts.
So the spring of 1963 in Birmingham became summer, and summer became fall, and school was now back in session. On Friday, the 13th of September, Freeman spoke briefly with Cynthia Wesley as they left for the weekend.
She was always supportive of me when other kids were bothered that I was so enthusiastic about math. She would be proud of me and told people they should be too. As we were leaving school, everybody's running out, and I saw her in the door. I'd just come down the steps, and we greeted each other leaving, and she said, "See you Monday. See you Monday." That was it.
That was the last time he saw Cynthia. Freeman was sitting in the 6th Avenue Baptist Church with his family that Sunday morning when everyone felt a slight vibration. Suspicions and fears were immediate. Reverend Porter, their minister, took the phone call.
And he was very, very astute in keeping people calm. He said, first of all, 16th Street, our sister church has been bombed. And just the whole church. Oh, and everybody was just, because people had relatives, sisters, and siblings and children at one church or the other. And he said a moment of prayer. And then he said, "Please leave quietly. Please leave quietly and slowly." And everybody just accepted that instruction. And we all left in a daze. The men went to that other church to see what they could do to help. The women and children went home.
Birmingham, Alabama, September 16th, United Press. A bomb shattered a crowded Negro church Sunday, killing 4 girls in their Sunday school class and triggering violence and terror that left 2 more persons dead in the streets. The blast that ripped the church at 10:22 a.m. injured dozens of persons, and at least 20 required hospital treatment. The explosion crushed 2 cars outside the church as if they were toys and blew out windows blocks away. The survivors, their faces dripping blood from the glass that flew out of the church's windows, staggered around the two-story brick and stone building in a cloud of dust raised by the deafening explosion. As police struggled to hold back the screaming crowd outside the church's pastor, Reverend John H. Cross, grabbed a megaphone and paced up and down telling the Negroes, "The police are doing everything they can. Please go home." "The Lord is our shepherd," he sobbed. "We shall not want."
My parents had agreed I could come to the funeral, and the principal of our school said, "You're going to be representing us," because it was a school day, and I had on a shirt and tie and a coat. And the principal was George Bell, the mathematician and my hero. And he said, "Come here, son." And he took off my tie because it was a light color. And at that time, you only wore dark black ties to a funeral. And he took off my tie and tied his tie on me. And that's when he gave me the pep talk and said, "I'm so proud of you, and you're representing all of us. And pray for all of us." Yeah. It was very special. Three of the families had agreed to have the funeral. The other one did not. And Denise, who was younger than the rest of us, was in the middle, so a smaller coffin. It was the only time then and still when I had seen a funeral with several coffins there, caskets there, and with these smaller coffins, all closed because the bodies had been dismembered. And we knew all of that.
This was the second time that year that Freeman had sat in that same church and listened to Dr. Martin Luther King. The first time in May, King had urged the children to march and take the risks. This time was different.
And remember, there were people who blamed Dr. King and all of us for having gone to jail, for having stirred things up, for having made people angry, and that was the reason people knew that the church had been bombed.
I say to you in conclusion, life is hard. At times as hard as crucible steel. It has its bleak and difficult moments, like the ever-flowing waters of the river. Life has its moments of drought and its moments of flood.
And so there he was, Dr. King, looking out at the audience over the coffins, these little girls, looking into the faces of those mothers and those parents. And you could see the pain in his face, the grief. And he said, "At times like these, all we can do is pray for strength. Let's pray." And he did just that with them. And it was such a solemn moment. And I looked, and it was the first time in my life that I saw whites in our church. And there were white priests and Jewish rabbi and just people from different faiths. And it was the first time I realized that I could see a white man crying for a little black girl. The tears were flowing. And I was so moved by that human connection very much.
To tell the story of September 15, 1963 in Birmingham, the name of Virgil Ware should also be mentioned.
Birmingham, Alabama, Associated Press. Two clean-cut white teenagers, both Eagle Scouts, were charged with first-degree murder Tuesday in the pistol slaying of a young Negro. Virgil Ware, 13, was shot to death on a bicycle in suburban Sandusky a few hours after four girls were killed as a dynamite bomb virtually destroyed a church Sunday. Bailey said that the white youths were returning from a segregation rally on a motor scooter when they met Ware and his brother at an intersection. Without a word, shots were fired. Lieutenant D.W. Orange of the Sheriff's Department said that both boys admitted the shooting in a signed statement. "They didn't give any reason," Orange said. "They were very emotional and cried a lot."
Virgil Ware's murder went largely unnoticed by history. He was the same age as the girls killed in the church that morning, but it went unnoticed because it was simply a common event. Even for Hrabowski, who was Virgil's age and who lived himself just 8 miles from where Virgil was shot.
It is still just a vague memory, because you see, we were accustomed to hearing about, over the years, about lynchings and blacks being killed. We black families were accustomed to black people being killed. Now, his was associated with that period and just as tragic, but the dramatic effect of little kids killed in a church that was so much more astounding, frightening. And that speaks to the times. When it happens in a church, it takes on an extra layer of complexity that the hatred is so bad, they'll come into the house of God. It's so sad to say that most of the children of people we saw killed were boys, as it is today. But for whatever reason, the idea of little girls, little black girls in their white, Sunday white, looking in a mirror, getting ready to go up and participate in the other part of the service in a church, being blown to pieces.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. Our guest is Freeman Hrabowski III, the newly retired president of the University of Baltimore County and the author, most recently, of The Resilient University, How Purpose and Inclusion Drive Student Success. When we come back, we'll hear how Freeman and his mother managed to cry and what their tears meant when they heard that Bull Connor had passed away.
There's another podcast you might like from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called In Good Faith. Stephen Cap Perry is the host. He visits with people of various faith traditions. These guests are generous and compassionate and share in their own words firsthand experiences of their faith, hope, and belief. It's a chance to deepen our collective understanding of what it's like to live a spiritual life. And by the way, Stephen has a global perspective. He has cultivated that over a lifetime of travel, and that enlivens every conversation he has. In Good Faith, an inspiring journey. Be sure to listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I had been struck in studying this period how graceful and mature the people around Martin Luther King were, in contrast to the spoiled children demeanor of so many of the white leaders and their followers. So I posed that question to Dr. Hrabowski. Were there actually grown-ups among the whites in Birmingham when you were a child?
I'm sure there were many white grown-ups. I think all of us were products of our experiences and of the times. As I have met a number of highly accomplished whites who grew up in Birmingham, we've compared notes. It's very clear we had many experiences that were the same. We are Southerners. At the same time, many people will say that there were some in their family who understood how unfair racism or the segregation was, others who just accepted it because it was what they had grown up with. And I think all of us in some ways were victims of our history. We tend to be products of our childhood experiences. And what happens in the home has a great impact on each of us. Now, sometimes people can rise above the limitations of the home about prejudices. Often people don't. My parents taught me to understand the role that Christianity should play in all of that. And so when I for years had such bitterness towards Commissioner Connor, Bull Connor, for his treatment of me when I was marching and he's throwing me into the police wagon and my going off to jail, I had such bitterness. And when he died, my mother called me. I was in college and my mother was crying for this man. And I said, why would you cry for him when he treated me so miserably? And she said something that I will never forget. She said, because he was somebody's child that unfortunately his mother had not taught him to love or not to be against people simply because of the color of their skin. She said, I'm so sorry that he died not understanding how wrong that was. And her saying that was cathartic to me. And before I knew it, I was crying. And I said, Mother, why would you do me like this? And she said, just think about it. And it was cleansing. It really was, because it took away the bitterness I had had before that. And it put him and those like him in perspective.
When you say that moment of forgiveness, forgiveness is a big word, but at least empathy and some measure of sadness for the tragedy of his life, there is a similar kind of tension anytime we look at our history or anybody's history, and you see people who were imperfect, like Thomas Jefferson. It's hard for us to accept the complexity of people, isn't it?
It is. We have to remember that no person is perfect. We have a tendency when thinking about the past to be somewhat one-dimensional in analyzing or understanding someone and just to think they were a forefather or they were John Kennedy or Martin King or anyone. And yet each of these people is complicated. Like me, like you, each had his, or in some cases, her flaws. Looking at the life of a person, you can't write somebody off simply because of the mistakes. You have to look at the whole person, seems to me. What good did they do? What is the difference they make? And I actually think we are better off when we understand that the people we look up to the most were as flawed as other human beings, that we begin to understand and we can be better. If we think that our leaders are close to perfection, then we simply say, well, we're not like that. But if we understand that every human being has made mistakes and every human being has flaws, and yet some rise to greatness in spite of those flaws, then it says to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Our conversation about flawed forebears drew us back to the question of Hrabowski's own heritage, about his great-grandfather, who was the son of a Polish-American slave master.
Yeah, and there are people who dispute it and all of that, but we've gone through it, and there are people who will say whatever, but we have the photos and things that show the mixed blood and all of that. I am proud of history, the good, the bad, and the challenging. We must speak the truth.
In that context, Hrabowski is very aware that he had some real advantages as a child, advantages that came ironically in part because after the Civil War, his family was given some land by their own relatives who had previously enslaved them.
When you have certain advantages in any generation, you can see the results. And so my dad could go off to college in the 20s because of certain advantages from generations and land and education.
Hrabowski had college-educated parents and a neighborhood and a church community where most adults were working professionals who looked out for kids like him.
And I was very fortunate, and I say this in one of my earlier books, Holding Fast to Dreams, that I grew up in a middle-class Black home in the early 60s. Under 4% of Blacks had graduated from college, but quite frankly, only about 11% of whites had graduated from college. But my parents were college-educated and had been teachers. Mother was a teacher. Dad had left teaching to make more money, and he worked in a steel mill and some other jobs to make more money and ended up teaching men of color in the steel mill, preparing them for the GED classes that my mother taught at night in her second job to help them get a high school diploma. That was the big thing, to help some adults get a high school diploma and to start sending some of the family's children to college. My home was about both faith and education. So my cousin, whom my parents adopted, and I were always in church. It seems like we were in church 2 or 3 times a week, and we were always studying. And we were always taught, you put God first in your life, of course, and then that education makes the difference. And so my parents and other adults, the principal, my Black doctor, everyone was Black in our community, and even the professionals, the few Black doctors and lawyers, but my dentist, and these were people we looked up to.
As we talked about these role models, Hrabowski mentioned their complete absence when it came to television. And then he noted the first time that he saw that change.
It was very clear from television that we didn't matter, because we didn't see people like ourselves. And the one or two shows that were on didn't present Blacks in a favorable manner. Until the show Julia with Diane Carroll came on sometime in the 60s. And she was a middle-class nurse. And she was presented as a decent human being raising her child. It was the first show I can remember where we weren't treated as clowns or buffoons.
At this point, Hrabowski couldn't resist pulling out his phone and looking up the Diane Carroll show. Googling in real time is a compulsion he got from his students, he says. I found it quite charming in a retired college president.
Sure. I have to tell you, turns out Julia didn't start. The first episode was in 1968. So I was actually 17. So I was in college then. I'm surprised. But yeah, and that was one we were really proud of.
In the clip you're about to hear, Julia, Diane Carroll's character, is interviewing for a job as a nurse working in the office of a cranky psychiatrist. She tells him that her husband, who was a captain in the Army, had been shot down and killed over Vietnam.
So you think we should give you employment because you are the widow of a war hero, huh?
Certainly not. I think you should hire me because I am a competent RN. I have had 4 years' experience in surgery, emergency, and psychiatric cases. And I am dedicated to my profession and skilled in it. And what's more, I can handle even the most exacting demands of a mean, gruff old man with the heartwarming manners of a wounded moose.
It's not hard to see why Julia's character would have been so refreshing to a young Hrabowski. Again, we see in her that absolute refusal to compromise on justice combined with a calm confidence, hope, and composure. It's a disposition that for Hrabowski goes back to his roots, unmistakably tied to that community, to his faith, and to his family.
The question Dr. King had asked when I was so inspired by him in church was, how do we use our faith to not give up hope so that we remember that we are all children of God, that we have more in common than people realize across groups, across races or whatever? And that same faith has followed me throughout my life. And even when I was installed as president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County 30 some years ago, I needed to have my childhood minister and my adult minister there. And we had a Catholic priest and we had a Jewish rabbi and other people. And I wanted to show my appreciation of the faith-based community in a public university. And they said, now, but you're going too far when you say you got to have two Baptist ministers. I said, well, I have to have my childhood minister. I grew up under him, and my adult minister would not be happy if he was not saying so. So I said, if you want me, you take all of me. So even there, I was wrapped in my conviction, and they gave in and gave me what I wanted, and it worked out well. But that faith has helped me through difficult times throughout my life.
Freeman Hrabowski has dedicated his career to helping students become better than they are. His new book, The Resilient University, is a capstone to that mission. It's a message that he feels has special urgency at this moment.
The chapters in the new book are so appropriate right now because it moves from my last book of empowerment to this one of resilience. And the chapters are vision, openness, resilience, courage, passion, and hope. Hope is the last one that I am most focused on in my talks with people because right now, people, students especially, see that our society is so divided. And they will say to me, Doc, we've never been this divided before as an American society. And I'll say, know your history. Because if we go back to the 1960s or the 1860s, we will see these divisions. All the people who've seen Hamilton, one forebear killing another in a duel. We've seen the violence in Congress. We've seen it with people beating each other with canes. So these things have happened before. I can say this for hope. Anyone who knew life in the 1960s would appreciate that we have made enormous progress, that this is a challenging time, that regardless of what political party you belong to or whatever, you have to admit we have made some progress. And now we have to have the hope and the belief in our country and ourselves to believe we can do much more, that we can get through this turbulent period and continue to make progress as we did in the 19th century and the 20th century. In our church, in many churches, there's a song, it's about we fall down. And the line is, we fall down, but we get up. So resilience.
Hrabowski sees a full circle connecting his life and that of Dr. Martin Luther King. The awakening that shaped Hrabowski's life path and his career, it began the night he first heard MLK speak in that church. And there is one theme he got from Dr. King's talk that night that's been central to his life as a Christian and his career as an academic.
We can be better than we are. I don't care how good you are, you can be much better. But I used it in the Harvard speech for MLK. I was invited to give the commemorative lecture, the 60th anniversary of Dr. King's speaking at the law school at Harvard in 1962. And it was especially meaningful to me because I spoke there on that same stage, knowing that 60 years before he had done so, but that he also, a few months after that, that next year, he had come to Birmingham and had inspired the children to march with him. If he had not inspired us, if we had not done some things we did, if the country had not moved in a different direction through the Civil Rights Act, through the Higher Education Act, I certainly would not have been as successful, as fortunate as I've been. And I wouldn't have been there speaking that day. And yet the message I gave to Harvard is that they are by far the most admired university in the world, and they do many good things. And yet I was saying to them about producing scientists, particularly scientists of color, and I was saying, and yet you can be better. You can certainly be better. What I said to them, I say to all of us, to my own university, but to our society, that we can be better than we are.
So what is divine discontent? I don't know if I can put it in words, but I think I know it when I see it. In Freeman Hrabowski and in those who helped shape him, it was that firmness in the right encased in a calm confidence in pursuing it. It was that recognition that all of us, as individuals and as a society, are flawed, but that this is not an excuse to give up. As he put it, we fall down, but we get up. And you can see in Freeman Hrabowski that there is joy and hope in that journey, despite the toil and the pain.
I quote Beckett. Beckett said about this guy in his book, Malloy, that he was studying the dancing of bees. And he said, here's something I could study all my life and never really understand. But he said it with great rapture, because the more he studied the dancing of the bees, the more he realized there was so much more to know. And that dancing of the bees has to do with how they communicate. So he was beginning to understand it, but then he went, wow, yeah, I'm just starting to understand. I've got to keep going, right? And I use that when talking about what it should mean to be an educated person. It is not that we've attained a certain level. It is that we know how to learn, how to think, how to learn, and that we are hungry, that we want to know more. Because the more we know, the more we realize there's so much more to know and understand.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. It's a great honor to have been able to visit with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski III, whose work spanned two generations helping college students expand their vision. A man who, as a boy at the age of 12, persuaded his reluctant parents that he must not only witness history, but help shape it for the better. Dr. Hrabowski recently retired as president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and his new book is The Resilient University: How Purpose and Inclusion Drive Student Success. Today's episode of Constant Wonder was produced by me with help from Tenery Taylor and Lily Jensen, and with sound design by James Call. The guitar version of We Shall Overcome was performed by the O'Neill Brothers Group, and we'd like to thank them for letting us use it. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.